In the past 18 years, close to 30 million American children have been killed in their mothers' wombs by abortion. Now, there's another issue of death on the horizon, and the rhetoric sounds chillingly familiar. It's the Right to Die movement, which has been made popular by the Nancy Cruzan Supreme Court decision and Dr. Jack Kevorkian's suicide machine. My name is Bob Allen, and joining us today will be Rita Marker, director of the International Anti-Euthanasia Task Force at the University of Steubenville in Steubenville, Ohio. Rita, on behalf of Dr. Kennedy, it's my privilege to welcome you again to Truths That Transform.
Well, thank you for having me back.
Recently, of course, we had the Supreme Court decision on the Cruzan case. Let's talk a little bit about the implications of the final decision.
The Cruzan case and the results of that and the implications have been really confused, I think, in much of the reporting. The Cruzan case, for the listeners, would be, I think we possibly could go over some of the basics on that. It was a case of a young woman who was severely brain damaged as a result of a car accident, receiving her food and water as by means of a feeding tube that was put in to make her care easier. And then her parents had requested, in fact, wanted to order the health care workers to stop giving her food and water. The case went clear to the Supreme Court, and the court was faced with the question, could a state, the state of Missouri, be forced to require its health care providers to starve and dehydrate patients to death? The Supreme Court, in its Cruzan decision, came down in a way that gave Nancy Beth Cruzan herself a reprieve from the death sentence that had hung over her head. In other words, her food and water could not be removed as a result of that decision as long as she is in Missouri and as long as Missouri law does not change. But the court decision said, in the whole decision, the main part was that a state, for example here Missouri, can require that a person has left clear and convincing evidence that they want to be starved and dehydrated to death. And if that is the case, then you can remove their food and water. All they said is that a state could require clear and convincing evidence. The court did not say that the state has to require clear and convincing evidence. So while Nancy Beth Cruzan is safe in Missouri right now, people in similar situations in neighboring states are not. So that there need not be clear and convincing evidence. Someone can just say, it would be better if this person is dead. That happens in Arizona, for example. It happens in California. So it ended up being very much a state's rights sort of situation, that each state can decide what the criteria will be for deciding that food and water can be removed from someone. So it was a good decision in that Nancy Cruzan was protected for now, a bad decision in that it has said it's up to a state to decide what the criteria will be for removing food and water from people who are severely debilitated. Now, what are the implications? Well, the implications are that states could just say, if a guardian requests this, it's to be done. And the implications go much further than that, and I think we've possibly talked about this before. If we can say, all right, this person shouldn't have food and water because she'd be better off dead, then it is no leap of logic. In fact, it is the most logical progression to say, since we're going to kill this person by starvation and dehydration anyway, it would be much kinder to give a lethal injection or an overdose of some type. So the Cruzan decision did not further open the doors to death on demand as euthanasia proponents had hoped. It didn't do it in the way they had hoped, but it certainly did not grant total protection in any way to people who are particularly vulnerable.
Moving to another recent news item involving a specific euthanasia proponent, Derek Humphreys, the executive director of the Hemlock Society, divorced his wife recently, allegedly because she was diagnosed with cancer. Let's talk about those circumstances, some of his philosophy, and then the situations concerning both his first and now his second wife.
Okay, that case and the whole public scenario began last September. And it was really ironic because Derek Humphrey came to power in the euthanasia movement largely on the basis of his description of his treatment of his first wife when she had breast cancer. And in fact, 15 years ago, he gave his first wife a mug of coffee laced with a lethal dose of poison and said that he kissed her goodbye and sat by her bed with two pillows in case that she didn't die of the poison. He was ready to smother her. In fact, he wrote that in his book. He has always contended that this was a compassionate and loving act and that this is what she requested. Of course, there's no way to find that out for certain because Jean Humphrey, his first wife, is dead and we have only his word for it. But we can get an indication, possibly, of his care and treatment toward people with life-threatening illnesses by looking at his treatment of his second wife. His second wife, Anne Humphrey, who, by the way, was the co-founder of Hemlock. She and Derek Humphrey founded Hemlock in 1980. Anne Humphrey was diagnosed as having breast cancer last September. And following surgery, she was to begin chemotherapy. That was 3 weeks after the surgery. On the third week after surgery, Derek left to go on a trip to talk about compassion and care for people with terminal and life-threatening illnesses, and left a message on the couple's home answering device saying that he was not going to return, that he couldn't live through this madness again, and in effect, abandoning his second wife. Now this, to even consider what happened to Anne Humphrey, I think really is to realize that within the space of 3 weeks, she lost her health, her husband, and actually her profession, because recall, she was the co-founder of Hemlock and the deputy director of the organization. That was followed by a very difficult time for Mrs. Humphrey, and as the reports have clearly stated, a great deal of shutting her out of any type of support by Hemlock members and those who have said that they are only looking at compassion and dignity and caring for people. In fact, the locks were changed on the office doors, and very brutal sorts of memos began to circulate within the organization and to the outside of the organization. It was really an amazingly cruel time and a very, very difficult time for Mrs. Humphrey, because going through the chemotherapy and also facing the possibility, for example, of losing her health insurance and many, many different things. And Mrs. Humphrey herself, after reflecting on it and on a number of radio and television interviews, has said that this has led her to do some rethinking. One of the things she said she had not been aware of before was the subtle and not-so-subtle pressure that can be put on someone to die and simply get out of the way. She has said that Hemlock appears to have a two-step process, that you find out that you have a life-threatening illness, and then you'd better decide how you're going to die, because there's no help, no support if you want to continue to live. She also has said that looking back now, she feels that if she could talk with Jean Humphrey, Derek's first wife, and ask her what really happens, she has a feeling that the answer would be rather chilling. I think that this should really be something that people think about a lot, because it is so easy for the Right to Die people, the euthanasia people, to talk about the words compassion, care, support. And yet when it comes down to the actions, it comes down to the practice, that care and support isn't there. It goes even further as far as the pushing toward death. In June, I was in Holland for the World Federation of Right to Die Societies meeting. And by the way, Derek Humphrey was president of the organization at the time through June. And he announced at that meeting that Hemlock now has support groups for people who are planning to commit suicide. Now, these support groups are not to support people to continue to live, but to support them in their decision to be dead. There's a grotesque sort of support offered here, and that is, we will support you all the way to the grave, but no place else.
Let's move our attention now to another well-publicized case of recent times, and that deals with the suicide machine incident. Give us some of the background on that case.
Well, that was the case of Janet Atkins and Dr. Jack Kevorkian. And Janet Atkins, she was 54 years old from Portland, Oregon, and her husband, Ron, both, by the way, were members of the Hemlock Society. The doctor involved was Jack Kevorkian, an unemployed pathologist from Royal Oak, Michigan. Kevorkian, qu- quite some time ago. He's been making his views known as to what he was planning to do. And in 1986, there was an article describing his machine that he had developed. But he really didn't hit the national spotlight until last fall, when he went on the Donahue Show, and also it was reported in a number of other publications that he was planning to use what he then called his self-execution machine. His little self-execution machine is a metal pole with three bottles, and the mechanism is that he inserts an IV line into the person's vein. It starts saline, and then the person or victim, as I think is more appropriate, pushes a button, and that starts the flow of barbiturates or sedatives, and then automatically potassium chloride to cause heart seizures. Kevorkian's machine, and the fact that it would probably be legal in Michigan, was reported in the National Hemlock Society's newsletter in March. And Janet Atkins and Rod Atkins, recall, were members of Hemlock. In June, Janet Atkins, who had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and her husband flew from Portland, Oregon, and as the reports have stated, Janet Atkins herself had not contacted Kevorkian about this. Her husband had done so. And when they flew to Michigan, the arrangements were made for Kevorkian to use his machine for the first time on Janet Atkins. And this was done in the back of a rusty old van at a campsite just north of Detroit. What has been described as death with dignity actually took 5 hours in the back of that rusty van, because Kevorkian couldn't find the vein the right way, and then he dropped some of the solution and bumbled all the way through. But interestingly enough and chillingly enough, the reaction to what Kevorkian did changed very rapidly. The first day or so, there was outrage expressed that this doctor did this to this woman in the back of a rusty van in Michigan. The day following that, the National Hemlock Society released a press release saying that they would hope that actions like those of Kevorkian would not be subject to ambiguity and, in fact, would be made legal. And we began to see reports from people in rather prestigious positions, law schools, and even the executive editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, saying, wait a minute, let's look at this. You know, we really ought to consider this. Sure, back of a rusty van wasn't a very good place, but really, isn't it time that we decide that maybe it is okay for a doctor to do this? And so Kevorkian and his bizarre ideas, which also include, by the way, experimenting on infants and children and people with disabilities, and then if they don't die, the experimentation to kill them. He wrote that in a German journal, Medicine and Law, in 1986. Kevorkian all of a sudden became the folk hero, referred to as a brave and lonely pioneer. And I think it's important to look at what's involved here. We can't know for certain what Janet Atkins really wanted or did not want, nor can we say that she was pushed into this. That would be unfair and untrue. But we have to ask some really hard questions. Janet Atkins has been reported as being a very active lady who was very involved in all kinds of things. She taught French, and she taught music, and she even climbed mountains. And then she found that she had Alzheimer's. Now, that's a devastating sort of blow. But being the kind of person she was, it was reported that she really handled it with a great deal of grace and courage. Her husband, after her death, said that she handled things well, but that he couldn't handle it, that he was crying all the time, and that it was just really difficult for him. Now, I think a question should come up, and that is, did Janet Atkins, after she realized that she had Alzheimer's, did she have to deal not only with that real blow as to her prognosis, but also did she have to deal with a difficult situation of supporting her husband emotionally? And did she feel that she really had to do this in order to make things easier for him? A couple of things that might help us in considering it is to say, all right, we've heard that she said she wanted to do this, but she's not the one who contacted Kevorkian. Now, is it possible that she said, I want to do this, hoping that everyone would say, don't do this? Is it possible that when she asked someone, if she asked them to contact Kevorkian, that she was hoping they would say, I won't do it? Would she then have done it herself? We don't know. But we do know that it must be very, very difficult for a person who gets a diagnosis of a life-threatening illness to say to someone, I want to die, and then to have that person say, okay, did Janet Atkins in the back of that van in that Michigan park feel a tremendous abandonment and loneliness? And did she feel like she was forced to be there in order to help her family? And if this is the sort of situation that is possible at this time, what will it be like if this becomes totally legal and acceptable, as is now being promoted on the West Coast?
What some people may not know is that another assisted suicide has taken place in Michigan more recently. Rita, tell us about this new incident.
The second case is another man and his wife, also, as I understand, members of the Hemlock Society, who flew from California. And they did not make use, as far as we know, of Kevorkian's machine. Instead, they flew to Michigan and used a method that has been described very clearly on a step-by-step basis in the Hemlock literature for killing someone, and that is to take a dose of barbiturates and put a plastic bag over your head. And that was the means used to kill a lady by the name of Mrs. Harper. Her husband, who flew with her from California and was there at the time, has been charged with murder. This is a different county in Michigan, and so it will be interesting to see what the outcome of this will be.
What are your thoughts on the future for all of these type of incidents across the country?
Well, I think the future for all of these types of incidents is that they will only increase unless people who are horrified about this rise up and say no, no, no. As much as people have gained an increasing amount of awareness of this, I believe that there is still a tremendously naive attitude toward this, as though this is something that is just an unusual occurrence, that this can't happen here, that never here would we have suicide clinics, nor would we have a situation where someone can kill a relative and say, well, it's okay because they asked for it. And until people realize that this isn't something that might happen, but this is a very real possibility, and until the people who realize this are willing to take the time and the effort to stand up and say, this is wrong, and this cannot be done, then I think we're going to see this increasing. And we may end up with people looking back and saying, but what happened? Well, what happened was that nobody thought it could ever happen here.
Do you see similarities between the abortion battle fought about 20 years ago and the so-called right-to-die battle being fought right now?
Oh, yes, yes. In fact, in many cases, one could just substitute the word euthanasia for abortion. You know, prime illustration of that is what's happening in Washington State right now. 20 years ago, there was a big political campaign going on in Washington State. And during that campaign, those on one side said, look, we only want to change the law to bring it up to modern technology. And we only want to do it for the hard cases. Anybody who opposes this, they're just being hysterical. That particular political battle was the battle over what was called Referendum 20. It was a battle to make abortion legal up until the 16th week of pregnancy in the state of Washington. Washington is the first and the only state that ever approved abortion by a direct vote of the people. Heading up that particular political campaign, or one of the main organizers, I shouldn't say he headed it up, but he was one of the main organizers, was a Unitarian minister by the name of Ralph Muro. And he talked about things like choice, and he talked about things like hard cases, and the fact that there would not be any abuses. That was 20 years ago. That was in the state of Washington. Now, in the state of Washington, there is a heated political campaign gearing up, and signatures are being collected across the state of Washington to amend the existing living will law to allow aid in dying. Aid in dying, by the way, is the nice way Hemlock people have phrased what is currently called first-degree murder. but they call it aid in dying, and it would legalize it. It would mean a doctor could directly give a lethal dose or lethal injection to a patient. The person who is heading up this whole thing, the director of Washington State Hemlock, is none other than a Unitarian minister whose name is Ralph Miro, the same Ralph Miro who headed up Washington Citizens for Abortion Reform. I think it's ominous that Washington State, being the first and only state to approve abortion by a vote of the people, has the possibility, although we hope it won't happen, of becoming the first and only place to approve doctors killing already born people directly and intentionally and making that legal.
Obviously, it's a bit different for those who are in the state of Washington from those who are in other areas of the country at this present time, but what can we be doing on the local level and the state level to make sure that the right to die does not become an issue here where we are?
Well, I believe the right to die has become an issue in every state, the so-called right to die. While Washington right now, you see people on the street corners collecting signatures, this sort of promotion is going on in every state. For example, in Oregon, there are four legislators who have said they will introduce similar legislation in the next legislative session. In Florida, this is where another state that is being targeted for this. And recognize that it isn't just through legislation that this is going on, but in practice. Look at Michigan, where some people are saying, oh my, this might become a euthanasia paradise. So again, what can each person do in his or her own state is to become very, very, very well informed, to be able to respond to questions, and also to be able to help people to sort through some issues that have been made very complex, often are not complex, but have been made very complex by those who are trying to befog the issue. So the most important thing that people can do as far as action outside of their own homes is to share, to become informed and to share this information. The, of course, very, very most important thing is that when people are praying for particular needs, that they not forget that there are a number of prayers needed, that people become, that they wake up, they become aware of this threat to life, and that they have the strength and the courage to follow through in protecting life. So everyone listening, I would beg them to pray that everyone involved in this battle have the strength and the courage to go on with it, and then that they themselves become involved in whatever way they feel called to do, whether it be sharing the information with the next-door neighbor or becoming a speaker or whatever it may be, but to please get involved so that they will not look back 5 years, 10 years from now and say, I wish I had done something about it.
Well, most people's schedules are rather full, and I'd like right now, in order to give an impetus to get involved, have you paint the picture of what will happen if no one gets involved today. Where will we be 20 years down the line?
20 years down the line, we'll be in a situation where, that is, if no one gets involved 20 years from now, we will be in a situation where death on demand will become, or will have already become, totally acceptable as far as public policy goes, where laws such as those which have been drafted by the University of Iowa, in which a child under the age of 6 could be killed at a parent's request, and a child 6 and over could request death for himself or herself, would be the laws of our land, where teenagers would be able to go into a suicide clinic and their parents wouldn't know it until they got a phone call asking where they'd like the body sent, and where people over a certain age or with a certain degree of disability would be expected to request death so that they would get out of the way. This is the sort of a society that we will live in 20 years from now if we don't do something about it today.
That is a sobering thought, and one which I think we probably will have to end on. Rita, I want to thank you for the information you shared with us today, and I pray along with you that many of us will take that call and not just look for someone else to get involved, but get involved ourselves. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Rita Marker is the director of the International Anti-Euthanasia Task Force, a division of the Human Life Center at the University of Steubenville in Steubenville, Ohio. And I hope you take very seriously what you've heard today. This is Bob Allen for James Kennedy. God bless you and have a wonderful, wonderful day. Truths That Transform is a production of Coral Ridge Ministries. Views expressed by guests on the program are not necessarily those of Dr. D. James Kennedy, Coral Ridge Ministries, or this station.